welcome to another episode of Chatterbox with me, Mel Biggs. This month I am joined by none other than international melodeon hero and my very good friend, Andy Cutting. He joined me on my sofa here at home because he lives not very far away and he was available to come and visit. And we left the camera rolling for about an hour and a half and we could have easily gone on for a lot more. So this month's extended episode, available over on my Patreon, is quite juicy. In this episode though, we're going to hear a lot about his start as a melodeon player, how he got into Blows of Bella, and crucially, how it is for him playing with other people, because he's played in quite a lot of bands over the years and we're going to get to hear a lot of stories about that. Settle in, grab a cup of tea and enjoy this episode with Andy Cutting. Welcome to Chatterbox.
In person.
Andy Cutting on my sofa.
Hello.
Where you've been before, so.
I have.
Luckily, I'm very local and it's great to have this local friend and mentor and just wonderful person just up the road. Aww. Although you're barely there at the moment.
No, quite busy. Quite busy as ever, yes.
Where are you coming from and going to at the moment?
Coming from, I've been doing and I'm doing a lot of work with Anne Nepal, as you will know, I'm sure.
Last month's guest.
Yes, indeed, yes. Starting work on a new Leverett record. I know, very exciting.
Is this number 5 now or 4?
7.
Completely lost count. My gosh.
It'll be album number 7.
Of course, because you've had a couple of live albums.
A live album, yeah. The lockdown album. We thought we might try and make a live recorded live record, like the second one. And we bought a desk on tour with us with our sound engineer, Neil Ferguson, and multi-track the gigs, just to see whether it would work, not to make a record.
Just to test the process. But to see,
you know, if it was kind of good enough or we were kind of happy enough with it. So recorded it, did the tour and stuff, which finished on the 2nd of February was the last gig, 2nd of February 2020. And then, of course, the elephant in the room happened, you know. And we, about 2 months into that, Rob went, I thought I'd have a listen to those recordings. We did. Some of them are really good.
Great.
And so sent them out and we look at, you know, and it was like, well, actually, there's more than enough for a record in it. Yeah, let's put out a double record.
Oh,
double.
Fantastic.
So it was like, we thought we were then going to go, if it had worked, to then go and actually do it. But we'd done it.
Yeah.
So it was like a weird thing of we've made a record.
And it was no extra effort than just going on tour in the first place.
Doing some gigs.
And yeah.
I'm just off to France in 2 weeks' time to do a project with some Belgium and French musicians.
This is the Cuvée, is that correct?
Yeah, which Cuvée was Special.
Was it 2 years ago or something? It got flooded out, but you're going back to finish the album and finish the gig, is it?
Their 10th anniversary is being stretched, rather. I think this might be year 14 or something, if it's supposed to be the 10th. And they asked us whether we would play, and we went and we played for 5 hours.
An extra one just
we
because.
We played 40 things.
Wow.
And they want to record it and do it properly, so they're putting on a special event, which is in a couple of weeks' time. So, yeah, I have to go over it again.
And remember all the pieces.
Yeah, I have to. That's my work to do.
And is it a recreation of what you discovered between yourselves, or is it going to be new material that you're bringing to it?
No, it'll be what it is.
What you did.
What we did. I haven't played any of that stuff for 2 years. So I have, a bit of rehearsing to do.
But, I mean, just thinking, I've got a list here in front of me of all of the bands that I think I know that you've played with. And it is, I didn't count them up, but it's like half a sheet of A4. That's a lot of repertoire.
It is, you don't
strike me as, from my knowledge of your bands, which is fair few, because I'm a big fan. There's not a lot of repeated stuff. So a lot of this is just brand new repertoire that you are learning / creating. How does that work in your brain?
Okay. It has to be said that your half a sheet of A4 or whatever is, you know,
modest.
They're not, you know, things that are still happening necessarily. You know, I've been in lots and lots of different bands, with song-based bands and playing for dances and Kaylee bands and all concert bands and stuff. So on the go at the moment, I reckon I've got, I'm going to get my fingers out. I've got, I'll probably forget something. Blows of Bella. Topette, got the duo with Anne Nepal, occasionally play with Martin Simpson. I've got a duo with a German fiddle player and singer called Gudrun Walter.
Leveret.
Leveret. Did I have
Look over the list. We've got
and
Chris Wood coming back.
Yeah, that's not gone in yet.
We'll get round to that.
Solo. So that's I've got seven repertoires that are current.
Wow.
I think there's four melodies that are used in more than one thing. So how it works for me, it's like having a filing cabinet with lots of drawers. When I'm in Blowsabella land, I open the drawer of the Blowsabella and it's
There it
Blowsabella
is.
things. There it is. If you ask me now to tell you a Blowsabella or play a Blowsabella tune, I'd have trouble trying to remember it, recall it, but with a bit of thought. Or think of it like having a zip drive for your computer. You know, it's all zip. You click on it and it goes, unzip drive. Zloop,
Yeah.
and there's all the stuff there. And you go,
Is it in the muscle memory in your fingers?
for me, the key is the opening the drawer, unzipping the drive, is that, oh, it's that tune. What's that tune? Oh, yeah, Blowsabella. If I'm thinking of Toppat repertoire, in my I'm playing with Toppat, there's no way I could recall any Blowsabella repertoire whatsoever
Yeah.
at all unless I stopped and had a think. And the process of it's not repertoire but it's tune based. I open that tune, it's like whatever, the famous tunes of Blowsabella, the Rose of Arabia stuff. It's like, okay, yeah, I know it's in G minor, I know the shape, yeah, I can play it now.
Yeah.
I've got the shape, I recall the shape of the tune in my head and in my hands.
Is there any necessity for you at this stage? Do you have to continually go over that repertoire, or is it just a matter of what you just said and then it's suddenly there and you can play it
If
fluently?
it's in good question. I couldn't suddenly play what I played on Solveig's song Blowsabella. It's on vanilla or something, so that's 1990. I couldn't do that. I'd have to listen to it. If I listened to it, it would probably unzip my li open my little drawer in my head, and I'd go, oh yeah, all right, yeah.
Yeah.
I suspect that 8 times out of 10, it would be pretty accurate to what it would be, but that's through. I played that a lot. I just don't know why that song came to my mind, but. Lots of things like that. If I've learnt them right and played them enough, it's easy. It's really, really easy. And it's not, I'm not saying it's easy for me to do because
Yeah.
it's easy. It's not easy. It's really hard to do. But if you put in the work, the rehearsal, the practice, the repetition, for me, what works is repetition at home, but more importantly, once you've kind of got the idea of how it works, the way it gets solidified and made, solid, unbreakable thing, is by going and doing it live. So if you play loads of stuff, do loads of gigs playing that repertoire, it has a much better chance of sticking. I'm finding that certainly with a duo with Anne Nepal, is that. Now we've started finally to do more gigs. It's starting to, not that I didn't enjoy it, but I'm starting to really enjoy it a lot more because I'm not worrying about part of the arrangement and then it goes into that little loop and that little figure comes in there and that drops out there and that does that and I have to wait there and start coming, it's the different bass line. All that stuff, which is normally what's going through my head when I'm not so familiar with stuff. So now we're doing more gigs, and it's the doing the gigs that makes the difference. So now we have stuff in our repertoire that we've played enough to not have to, for me personally, not have to think
Yeah.
so much about.
I think that's one of the things I'm learning. We rehearse, we practice at home, but there's always that little bit of a cop out that if you make a mistake, you can stop and go back over it. Or, the feeling, the sensation's not the same as being in front of an audience, which
No.
really like anneals that. I think honestly, adrenaline is a big part of that
Yeah.
process,
Oh,
and
absolutely.
it's part of it might be nerves, but I'm not talking about that necessarily. It's just that I am going to perform this, and I want to do it to the best of my ability. It forces you to make decisions very quickly, particularly, say, if you push a note that's wrong, or you do, you say, well, I've got to now live in the moment with this. I've made this choice to do this. So, yeah, finding that sort of extra, it is just a step in the process of making it part
for me,
of
for
your
me,
bones.
The live thing is the bit that, you know, it's the catalyst that sets it all, you know, it's the rennet, it's the whatever that makes the cheese, rather than it just being milk and some curds and whey. You know, it's like, it makes it a thing. Here's an admission, some people, you know, probably won't even believe me, is that for me, my thing that I am just about most terrified about in the world is being on stage. I do not like it. I've never liked it. I don't live for being on stage, but it's a place where special stuff can happen that would never, ever happen sitting in a nice room or in the back room of a pub or in a studio or something magical can happen. Sometimes bad things can happen as well, but actually in experience in many thousands of gigs that I've done, rarely does anything bad happen. But to be on stage, I do not like it. I've never liked it, probably never will like it. Occasionally, I've learnt to live with it, but that's the place where special stuff can happen, you know.
Yeah, you learn to make accommodations, and kind of, maybe I'm just projecting my own sort of feeling here, because it's...
That's all right.
I don't think you've ever told me that, and we've known each other a long time, but I don't remember you saying it like that before, but I've also had my own demons getting on stage, and it's not
a
comfortable place to feel. But
I think very few people actually admit to it. But there are some people who live to be on stage. They adore it. Yeah. And I find that weird.
Yeah, same. I think it's about finding a control. I think for me, it's like I have a certain routine and things that I like to do before I get on stage. And when I am on stage, I like things to be around me. It's kind of like creating my own little sanctuary up there. I want the microphones in exactly the place that I want them to be, because then they're not going to be in my way. I'm not going to block that person out. And I suppose it can, to certain, you know, that the tech crew who only see me for that period of time of my life could probably think, God, she's quite highly strung. But I hope it doesn't come across like that. But I don't think it does. But it's just, you know, we all have our own way of dealing with that.
Oh, totally.
Making it feel normal.
Oh, completely. Completely, you know.
Coming on to some of these wonderful bands that you've played with, I'm going to start with the ones I'd actually only recently discovered, because I did my research for this. Fernhill. And actually, it was driving along with Anna Pack and listening to her incredible music archive. And you popped up on her car and I thought, that sounds like Andy Cutting, but I don't recognise the band. Where did that come from?
So Fernhill, as far as I'm aware, they still exist as a thing. I'm not 100% sure. So Fernhill was when I was in it, which was for 3 albums I did with them. It was a singer.
Yeah, I mean, it was her voice. I'm not normally someone who's grabbed by a vocal or lyrics, but her voice to me is like an instrument.
Yeah,
incredible.
So Julie Murphy is her name. And she's originally from Romford in Essex, and she talks like she's from Romford. She's hilarious.
No way.
But she speaks Welsh, and she's married to other person in Fernhill called Kerry Rees-Matthews, who is an extraordinary musician. Oh, I joined the band. It wasn't even a band. It was a recording session at the end of it, or during the session, I was told that I was now in the band.
Oh, right.
It was something called Fernhill. There was a guy called Jonathan Shoreland.
They liked what you did so much.
Well, it was a session, and they wanted to go and do some gigs, so it seemed obvious to have the people playing on the session. So we toured quite a lot for a few years. We did quite a few British Council things and stuff. It was amazing. Lovely. Bizarrely, you should say that. I've got a gig with Julie and Kerry at a festival in Belgium in May.
Wonderful.
I know. Bizarre.
Well, there we go.
And I haven't seen Julie and Kerry for 7 years, 8 years or so.
Well, I mean, if you're in Belgium, I recommend going to see this particular lineup of Fernhill. It sounds like good times.
Totally.
The other thing that struck me with that as well, because I've not heard you ever do much of this, is it seems very Breton or Celtic, you know, Welsh dance, Breton dance, the rhythms and the tunes you're playing.
Absolutely. Well, there's this funny thing. It's a thing that Kerry Rees-Matthews has done lots, and Julie as well, but Kerry a lot, of trying to find Welsh tunes to go with Welsh songs. Lots of traddy Welsh songs have lost tunes. Mm. And if you get Breton tunes, They work.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Celtic nations, the
Absolutely.
Celtic different countries.
Cornish is the same. And they're thinking,
exactly. Yeah. So that happened. So I knew nothing about it, but Jonathan Shoreland, who was a flute player in the band when I was in it, he played a lot of Breton music and stuff. So I kind of heard lots through them. And in fact, it's the only time I've ever been to Brittany and played was with Fernhill.
Mm. You are known so well on the continent. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to even say it like that, because I travelled to France last summer. I've known people on the continent for donkey's years. And whenever you go, you always hear Blows of Bella tunes, yours or Joe Freya's mostly, but also Dave Shepherd's Rose of Raby is very common on the playlist over there.
Oh, yeah.
I've just recently come back from Belgium with a workshop with Simone Battasso, who rates Blows of Bella as his Bible.
Yeah.
And it's just wonderful. We had Luca Thibault on and he said, oh, Andy Cutting, I went to a workshop of his, and for him it was all about the engines. What's it like to know that you are so well known and so well respected? Revered.
Utterly surreal. Because it's like, I'm just a bit bored. I'm a bit of a boring person, really. I'm a bit obsessed with the weird thing that apparently you lot seem to kind of like. And
that being the melodeon.
I always play in the box, you know, the diatonic button accordion, yeah. Sorry. If you set out, without trying to be too philosophical about it, if you were to set out at the age... So I started playing when I was 60, 2 weeks before my 16th birthday. That's when I first... started playing the box obsessively for 9 months. I shut myself in my bedroom, listened to John Kirkpatrick, 3 in a row, the English melodeon, and just tried to copy him as best I could, you know, in a very obsessive way. But if you set out, I think, creatively to make a mark on the world and change, you know, move something as some artistic thing forward, there's only one thing that I think you're pretty guaranteed of happening, and that is not that. I would say that
you'd miss your mark.
You would totally, because you're trying to do something that nobody knows, that doesn't exist, that you don't know how to do. Nobody knows how to do a thing. What I think is I was in the right place at the right time with the right tools, the right kind of amount of hard work, a kind of ability, whatever that is. Ability is hard work, you know. Hard work put in, ability comes out, you know. Whether that ability is good or bad, who knows? Who's to say? You know, it's like, is that a good painting? Is that the best painting in the world? Or is that, you know, I love it, I hate it, you know, who's right and who's wrong, you know. It's impossible for me to have set out to do that. All I knew is that I was obsessed with what John Kirkpatrick was doing and very confused as to why there weren't many other people who were as, I don't know what the right, virtuosic, brilliant, whatever, as him. There were some people in England, you know, this is England, absolutely.
And this is
because that's all I know, all
mid-80s?
I knew. Yeah, yeah. So I was kind of obsessed with that thing and how John did the thing. And also I used to go, I was in the Morrisside and we used to go, or I was dragged out to see Morrisides from the age of 4 with my older brother. My parents danced. And so I heard the music, I saw the dancing, I heard the music and some good players, some not so good players, but I had no idea when I was very little. And then as I was getting up, my brother studied classical violin. And, you know, in the classical world, you know, the line between international soloist and absolute beginner is there's a continuous line between those of standards, abilities. And in the world of box playing, well, that didn't exist. So I was very confused as to why, you know, there were other great players. Roger Watson was, you know, he was fantastic, you know, player. Yeah, players like Martin Ellison, Katie House and...
Tony Hall?
Tony Hall, absolutely Tony Hall. But there weren't many.
Yeah.
And in the local Morrisside, I was really lucky. There was a great guy called Pete Thompson who was, I mean this with a huge amount of love, very functional, but a good player, good solid dance player, really good, lovely session player and stuff. And a brilliant guy called Ian Dedick who plays for Hammersmith Morris. who basically took me under his wing and used to take me to sessions, you know, and it was fantastic. Back to your question, you know, it's like all I did was try to absorb as much as possible and hear what people were doing and try really hard not to be judgmental of, well, they're playing a John Kirkpatrick tune, well, they've got it wrong. Arrogant 16-year-old, you know, well, you're playing it wrong. You know, we've all met those people, you know.
They still exist.
Oh, yeah. They do, you know.
In their droves.
The number of times I've been told I'm playing tunes wrong is great, and nearly always when I'm playing one of my own tunes.
I was going to say.
Almost always. But it's like versions of tunes, you know, it's a funny thing. Anyway, so I wanted to just be, this is the arrogant 16-year-old, I wanted to be better than the average, and the average was the people that I heard play every week in and week out. And I most certainly was not better than average for quite some time. But then I made the kind of connection of the way John Kirkpatrick was playing and the way people I was hearing, and realising, the notes that people are playing of tunes and the actual written note, composed notes of those tunes aren't necessarily the same thing.
Yeah.
So I worked really hard on learning, trying to learn exactly what John was playing, not the overall effect of what I was hearing, because that can iron out what it actually is, you know. And then I was given, Ian Dedick gave me, did a cassette, and one side was a La Forcelle by Marc Perrin, on the other side was a record of a Italian guy called Riccardo Tesi. When I heard that, I knew the instrument, the diatonic, about the accordion, melodeon, as we insist on calling it. We're wrong. It's a one row with a 4/8 buttons. But anyway,
have your soapbox. This is your moment.
It's fine. It's fine. You can all laugh at me. It's great. Right on Melnet. He's still banging on about diatonic button accordions. It's what it's called, sorry, and all that. Anyway, melodeon. But I knew that the instrument that Marc Perrin was playing was a melodeon, 3-row diatonic button accordion. Yes, it was tuned in different keys. I assume it was GC box. Had no idea. But what the music that came out of my little cassette player played on that instrument, which I knew was the same as the instrument, my 2-row Hohner poker work, it was the same, it worked the same way. And yet the sound was like, well, it's not that instrument. It doesn't sound like John Kirkpatrick, so it obviously isn't that instrument. And then listening to Riccardo Tesi's record, it was like, you can play this instrument in a different way. So I just went, tried to learn some of the tunes off those records, even though they were in different keys. It was on a cassette, and the cassette player was running at a different speed. So it was like, it sounded horrific, me trying to learn. But I suppose it just opened up my world of going, I like this, I like that, I don't care for this, I don't care for that. Love John Kirkpatrick and stuff, but the way that he's playing that, I kind of prefer it a bit smoother, a bit more like that, a bit more... To me, it sounded exotic. I'm from Harrow, northwest London. Anything could sound more exotic than that, you know. So I just made up a couple of tunes, and I got to see it at Sidmouth Folk Festival. And our local folk club was massively influential on me. It was a Monday night folk club. Had some amazing people from the folk world, from Europe, who would come over and play big gigs, you know, weekend festivals. And on the Monday, they'd grab them to play at the folk club on the way back. I got to see a trio called Beau Temps sur la Provence with Evelyn Girardon, Jean Blanchard, and a box player called Michel Pichon. I hadn't a clue. I just knew they were from France. And they played the fiddle, the bagpipes, the hurdy-gurdy, accordion, and sang. I got to see loads of... I saw Riccardo Tesi in my folk club.
Well, I knew that you'd met him and he was influential on you, but I didn't realise how that had come about.
Yeah,
so.
He was playing with a guitar player called Alberto Ballet. It was extraordinary just to see somebody play that was physically, you know, to be in the same room, to visually, you know, YouTube wasn't a thing.
Yeah. And you hadn't seen John Kirkpatrick playing live at this stage?
I had seen him several times over the years, but I didn't know, because I didn't play the box and I was a kid.
Right.
But I did, in my 9 months of working stupidly hard, he played a concert. He did an illustrated history of the melodeon. Ian Dedick took me to that. It was amazing because I was trying to learn to play some of those tunes. And he played them and I could see how it was done. It was like, oh my God, okay, you can stop now. I can go home and just practice. I don't care
take
about
that
the rest
mental
of the
snapshot
game.
And take it home
exactly
with you.
Exactly that. All these influences, you know, I just got to see them all in a very short amount of time. And then I was playing with a local guy who was a singer and stuff, and they did a support slot for a band called Blowsabella at a benefit for Islington Green Party. And I met Dave Roberts, who was the box player with, and after the gig, we sat in the bar and played tunes, which was just lovely. And that was where we kind of first crossed paths with Blowsabella. And then a few things happened. I got invited to the early music exhibition to play a few tunes with Nigel Eaton, the hurdy-gurdy player at the time with Blowsabella. And then Dave Shepherd, the fiddle player, and Dave Roberts left, and they asked me whether I would. Well, they never asked me. They said, do you fancy coming along and sitting in with the band on a few tunes that he knew? But I knew them all.
Yeah.
So I did the whole gig with them and then did some more gigs. That's the thing. When I said I had the right tools and I was in the right place at the right time, I happened to be at a gig with Blowsabella when their fiddle player was just leaving and the box player was just leaving. And that's how that happened.
I'd also heard that Ricardo had sort of put a good word in with, was it Paul James at the time or was it?
So, yeah, I missed that bit out. There was a workshop. It's one of the only workshops I've ever been to. Ricardo Tasey was running the workshop, but he GC box and everyone else had DG boxes. And basically it was like,
carnage.
It was almost a car crash as a workshop, and Paul was helping Ricardo to run it. And in that involved, Ricardo wanted to hear some English box players, and there were various people there. And then Nigel spotted me in the room and said to Paul, get him to play. I looked about six or something, I think. I stumbled my way through a couple of tunes, you know. And apparently Ricardo then went up to Paul James and said, you need to get him in Blowsabella. Which is kind of what a nice thing to
happen. Ricardo.
Again, back to the question. It's like all this time, you know, making up little tunes. And then I joined this band that had, you know, international reputation. You know, Blowsabella's always been far bigger in what's now Europe, you know. I think lots of people in England just don't realise that at all. But
I don't even know. I remember myself growing up in the session scene, or, you know, the Morris scene, which was, you know, also the session scene, the folk world. And there'd always be these lush tunes played in sessions. And like, oh, what's that? Oh, it's a Blowsabella tune. And it was just this soundbite that lived in my head until I, you know, discovered the band and discovered you.
Yeah.
I was like, what? Sorry? Why aren't we talking about this band more over here? Yeah. You know?
I think there's a, you know, there's always been an English problem with Blowsabella, is that, and it's similar to thing Anne Newpold said to me. What it is that in England, most people in the folky acoustic-y world who've vaguely heard of Blowsabella, they go, oh, it's that French band. They play French music.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's still, people still think that, and they will always think that because that's what they've got in their brains, you know. Anne said to me, yeah, it must be strange for you because in England, everyone thinks of you as you play all this foreign European stuff. And in Europe, everyone thinks you play all of our stuff, but in a really English way. They think everyone plays like me in England, which is kind of cool, you know.
Yeah.
The pressure's on.
Yeah, well, for sure. Yeah.
It's very, very bizarre. So, yeah, the Blowsabella thing, it gave me a massive platform. So the first year, so I joined at the end of 1988.
That was the year I was born, by the way, just to kind of...
All right then. Okay, so I've been playing the box for 2 years.
Yeah.
When I joined Blowsabella, professional full-time band.
Future Mel, just interrupting really quickly to let you know that I've had to shave down so many stories that you've already heard, but also future stories that Andy's going to tell you about his first gig with Blowsabella, working with Roger Daltrey from The Who, working with Anne Neopold, the new Leverett album that's coming out. If there's anybody out there he hasn't worked with who he would like to work with in future, there's so many things that I just wasn't able to include in this free public podcast. But if you are interested in getting hands on the extended edition, then you can sign up to my Patreon. I'll leave the link in the description and you can get all of the extended episodes from the previous guests and anything that happens in future. So go and check that out. Now back to the interview.
I was just lucky, very lucky.
but also really just dedicated and focused to finding your own way with it, really. Like, yes, you kind of attached yourself really solidly to these other players to learn from them, but then, like you say, you filtered out what you wanted from that and kind of like created your style quite quickly.
Oh, but I think an important thing to say is I didn't try to make a style.
Sure.
I tried to do things that I liked. I like that bit of Ricardo. I like that bit of, you know, Mark Perrone. I like that bit of John Kirkpatrick. I like that bit. All these different people. And, you know, people nobody's ever heard of. You know, a massive influence was a guy called Bruce Warburton. Nobody will have ever heard of him at all. He used to play for our local Morris, or one of the local Morris sides and stuff. When he was in his 20s, he decided, oh, there's a women's Morris side. I'm a bloke. I'm single. That seems like a really good thing. Oh, what's this? So he got a box and learnt to play it. He had no influence on how he played, so he just played in this.
Mm.
And I think if there is anyone I play most like, it's probably this fella Bruce, you know.
I'm definitely somebody that's been influenced by the Morris guys who, after a set, you'd go to the pub and share tunes with.
Yeah.
And they're definitely the most influential on me for those early days of hammering the left hand and having quite a percussive style that I've kind of, well, people have complimented me on, people have noticed and mentioned, but I know what you're saying in that I didn't aim for that. It's just how it came out.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been the progression of everything.
It's that kind of human musical filter of going, if you don't like what somebody else is doing and you're trying to replicate, well, why are you doing it? I don't like it. I'm not going to waste my time trying to do a thing I don't like. I think there's a lot of mileage in the learning process. My first 9 months trying to copy John, I was trying to play to copy him, and that required a lot of work. After about 7 months of that, I did start going, he does it like this, but I kind of prefer a little bit like that, a little bit like that. It's not because I didn't like or appreciate what John was doing. I was just being influenced by Ricardo, Mark, other players, and going, I like that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try and do, not, I'm going to learn those tunes, that repertoire, you know, the European-y stuff from France and Italy, and naturally some of it, the stuff you like or that falls under the fingers easily, you start putting it on to other stuff.
Yeah.
And then you come up with your own. You know, I think the most influential thing, I suppose, that I have is that I have a particular style, a stylistic way of playing. It can be heard all over the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is, that's your question, it's really weird.
Yeah, but it's influenced not just a generation, but I would say at least two generations now, and more, and it will continue to do so. But you can hear your style in, and I hope this is okay to say, but Julian Sutton is very blended. And, you know, there were moments where Saul Rose is playing, although I think Saul does now stand obviously on his own. But there are moments in his history where, you know, I remember a story of you telling me where he tried to be like you and was kind of going through that phase in himself, you know, of just
trying to find yourself. You have to do it you know, find whatever way works for you. You know, it's like that stylistic thing is that, you know, that I made up, invented, whatever. I didn't invent it, I didn't make it up. It was a thing that I felt was the right way for me to play the box. I'm not saying it's right for anyone else at all, but history would say that apparently it works for an awful lot of people all over the world.
Yeah. It's an enjoyable way to play. I think that's how you've expressed it before. This is how I like to play it, the instrument.
But it's not, you know, it's right for me, and other people seem to get that. That's brilliant, but it has nothing to do with me. It's like that writing tunes, you know. It's like, I've written some tunes that have travelled, and it's like, I just wrote a thing that I liked. Thanks. Worst thing you can do if you're writing, you're trying to write, make up a tune, is to try and please people.
Yeah.
Because if you make something up and it doesn't really please you and you think it's going to delight everyone else and it's got loads of hooks in it and everyone will love it and nobody likes it, well, you've written a thing that nobody likes. If you write a thing that you like, there's something in it that you like, and nobody else likes it, one person likes it at least, and you like it, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But if you do that, there's probably a chance that other people, some other people might like it, some might not. You know, it's like my stylistic way of playing. Some people can't bear it, which is fine. It's great. We're all different, you know.
Yeah.
Back to the picture, is it good, is it bad, you know?
Yeah, exactly that, isn't it? Like, there's other things out there to listen to if you don't get on with that particular style. An interesting question that we've had from my Patreon.
Oh, cool.
And a chap called Brian, somebody who's new to my Patreon, so I don't know him that well, and I don't think we've ever met yet, but he posted about...
Hello, Brian.
About how playing with other people, which you are coming on my Patreon tonight, live on my Zoom, which it will have gone out by the time this podcast goes out, but you'll be able to get the replay if you sign up to my Patreon. So there's the little plug for that. All to do with playing with other people, which I can't think of anyone else more kind of equipped to do that workshop. Ryan seems to live in an area that doesn't have very few musicians. I think he's in America somewhere. So quite very spread out when you're playing Diatonic out there. But pending an opportunity to meet and play with other musicians, can you recommend some technical skills on the box or musical knowledge to be ready? At present, aside from solo playing skills, I am starting to play along to recorded music with the right hand chords. Any other suggestions? And I'm thinking, when you joined Blow Zabella, you'd obviously learnt to play with people in sessions, but as an accompanist, you know, elaborate on that. How those two things go together? Because there's playing melodies, but then there's playing, and you're so well known for your accompanying.
Yeah. It's chords, it's knowing your chords, and I don't mean in that kind of you've got a master's in music, you know, music theory. It's, for me, I don't really read music. I've got better in lockdown, it's got a bit worse since. But here's the thing, I used to have the telly on, I used to lie on my bed with my box eyes, and anything, any musical thing, adverts, anything that came on, I'd try and
work it out.
Not work out how to play it, but how something to play to go with it, whether it be, you know, a drone or a rhythmic thing or melodic thing or a harmonic thing. You know, on the telly, there's rarely an advert that's in G major or D major, you know, or E minor, you know, the safe, happy places on the box, you know. But just try and find something that works. And by doing it a lot, it became easier, and I could find things that worked quite quickly. Sometimes I haven't done it for years and years, but I used to do it loads. I totally appreciate the not. I get asked that a lot, and lots of musicians get asked that. How do I find people to play with? It's really, really hard. But your question is great of that. How do you give yourselves the tools so that when you find yourself in the position, I would find recordings and play along with them. It's fine doing stuff on your own. The problem with doing stuff in isolation without reacting to anything, i.e. playing with somebody else, even if it is a pre-recorded thing, is that you don't know if it works because there's no flag, there's no big red flashing light or a klaxon that goes when you harmonise it. Oh, it should have been a minor there, not a major.
Yeah.
You can't hear. Whereas simply just, you know, find some music that you like, you know, in any genre. Probably not a jazz kind of more, you know, something with a really complicated harmonic structure, chord sequence. Probably stay away from that just because it'll confuse you and it'll also make you think you're rubbish because unless you know that chord sequence, those changes, you don't stand a chance, you know, in your kind of initial steps. By all means, then go off and study those pieces.
Yes.
There's stuff online, you know, you've probably years and years worth of stuff online to do that with. But personally speaking, I would just listen to something you kind of like and try and work out how to play it. Whether it be, you know, this YouTube thing is just extraordinary.
Mm.
Phenomenal. It's like when I started my thing, as I said before, a cassette recorded from the speaker from a record player. That was how I did it. There was no amazing slowdowner. There was no pitch shift ability. So we're really lucky. So take a bit of time. Find a tune you like. Find a song you like. Get the amazing slowdown or whatever. Slow it down. be meticulous about it, slow it down, get it in a key that you know that you could feels like it could work on the instrument. Sit down, write down, write it down, whatever,
Yeah.
and then take it back up to tempo. Or, don't change the pitch. Learn to play in weird keys. Be like, there was a amazing box player in the Scottish Borders, I think he was, a guy called Ben Avaris, who didn't have a clue about his box, DG box, a bit like Tim Eadie
Say
in
that
the
name
coming to,
rings a bell, yeah.
who loved classical
Phenomenal.
music, got DG box, but just he made a little cassette of stuff. I do have it somewhere, and it's quite extraordinary of what no knowledge or teaching can do for some people. It's like no rule, rather
Yeah.
than loads of rules, no rules at all,
Just do what
and
you
playing
can.
classical music on it. And it's still sounds like I own a poker, but which is no bad thing, despite what people may think about me. Amazing, absolutely amazing thing, So
Don't be limited.
don't be limited, Try the no rules thing, but we all kind of like rules. It's a very human thing, But be prepared to just try different things and be prepared to get it wrong. It's like I'm forever saying to my kids and stuff, learn by your mistakes. If you make no mistakes, it's probably pretty boring. But you make mistakes, it's like, cool.
Yeah.
I know, I now know, don't go there
Yeah.
at that point. Brilliant. So I'm going to go somewhere else, and you might find some other thing
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
amazing,
Just making that choice in the moment to not go down that
Totally.
road that you just did, yeah. One of
Totally.
my big things as a teacher, and I sort of say this to so many people, when they get to a stage and like, oh, I want to play some French music, does that mean I'm going to have to buy a GC or CF or a different? I'm like, no, not at all. You can play any kind of music on a DG or any kind of other instrument. It's not a limitation in my opinion. The only thing is if you want to go to France and play in sessions there, then realize that they will predominantly be playing GC boxes. So then that's another question, another hurdle. But if it's just you at home by yourself and you want to work out some lovely French music, go ahead, knock yourself out and
Absolutely.
try and play it in D minor and G minor. It's, doable to a point on a two row, but it's part of that process of what you were just saying.
Absolutely. If you play with other people and stuff and they want to play things in different keys, I try very hard to limit myself to playing a DG box and a CF box. And that was simply because when I joined Blowzabella, lots of tunes, D minor and G minor. And it's so
Which are nice
much,
on a CF,
which,
if
yeah,
you
it's
don't
like
know.
playing an E minor or A minor
Yeah.
on a DG box. So it's just, so I deliberately limited myself to that until I made a B flat, E flat box. And then it's like,
It's pretty
oh,
much what you're
that's.
playing now, is it?
At home, I play. In fact,
Yeah.
I haven't played it for many months and I got it out this morning. I got my B flat, E
Is it
flat box out.
happy?
Oh, it's delighted.
Oh, good.
Almost as delighted as I was.
It's a very nice. I remember when you first made that with Emmanuel Parazel and you brought it to Wantage, I think. When I met Andy at a series of workshops that ran at the time in Wantage. And yeah, you just brought it back from France. You'd been with Martin Connolly, I think, making a box. Is that right?
Martin
Mark,
O'Connor.
sorry, Martin O'Connor. I'm thinking of two different people and merging them with one. And yeah, I thought, wow, he's made a really lovely box
Yeah, no, it is.
there.
I'm very,
And it's
very
just
lucky.
mellowed, isn't it, over
But
the years?
my word of warning about all that stuff is that as soon as you go, oh, I've got a GC box. Oh, I really want a CF box. Oh, a B flat E flat. Oh, an EA box. And suddenly it's like, suddenly,
You've got 18 instruments,
you've got, yeah, exactly.
which you've
That's
kind
which I've got. Yeah, it's great.
of.
But as my wife pointed out to somebody came up at a gig somewhere at a festival and was saying, asking me how many boxes I got. I said, and they turned to my wife and kind of said, "What do you think about that?" And she, mistakenly, I think, she said, "Well, the thing is, it's his job. If he says he needs another box, he needs another box." So I'm the winner. Delighted.
That's a rarity that you ever get that,
Oh,
but
yeah.
yeah, I think that tax deductible and all that. If you don't know already, Andy mentored me for a year, but it went on because you're such a lovely person and you were always at the end of the phone when I
Don't
needed
believe
you. But If for the official year that you mentored me, I think we met 5 times, one of which I can remember we did some stuff on 3-2 hornpipes. But yeah. We just chatted a lot of the time. But one of the things that I didn't ask you at the time, because as I've now had 10 or more years since that wonderful start to my career, I have learnt about communication and how important it is when you're working with other people.
Yeah.
You've worked with so many different types of people, different worlds, different, completely removed from the folk world, Roger Daltrey and Sting and different people. What is it to you to be a good communicator, and have you got any errors and boobs that you want to share? Like, I mean, obviously you probably have, but like, how does it work for you, and in terms of fitting in with other people and making a job work smoothly, but also having your opinion and voicing your opinion? Because I struggle with that.
It so depends on the situation. Basically, as soon as you step outside of the cuddly, cozy folk world, nobody has a clue what this instrument is. I did a session for a guy called John Isley, who was the bass player in Dire Straits, and it was at a studio of this guy called Guy Fletcher, who is related to Mr. Tumble. Those are people who have grandchildren of a certain age or whatever. I turned up to do this, and I got the box out of the case, and they were like, "Ah, oh, cool. And Guy Fletcher, who was producing, went, "You have got a proper accordion, though." I said, "What do you mean, like a piano accordion?" He went, Yeah.
Oh my God. I said,
I don't play a piano.
So he just didn't, he's just the knowledge of the world of accordions.
So you're in a situation where people don't know what you do, what you can do. And very often it's, if you're working with people, you know, have producers or have a strong idea, they will tell you what's what they want. You are, as a session musician in that situation, it's the sound they want, and they'll ask you to do impossible thing. I once got asked to play, this is a long time ago, it was a German singer signed to KTEL Records, some of you remember that, singing "Tie Me Kangaroo Down Sport" in a country and western style. At one point in the song, it changed key, went up a semitone every 4 bars.
Oh my God.
It was horrific.
I really want to hear that track.
I don't ever want to hear it ever again. You know, I played on Chumbawamba, one of their records, something. They decided it was one of their last electric records they did, and they decided they didn't want electric keyboards on the record for whatever reason, and they asked me whether I'd go and basically be the keyboard player on the record. But loads of their songs, their things are in weird, you know, weird key, A flat and, you know, C sharp major and stuff. It's like, not a chance. But the one of the band who was engineering it, who's now Leverett sound engineer, Neil Ferguson, he basically took the tracks. I said, "Look, I can do the, what key's this in? This track's in there. Okay, cool." He'd take the track, pitch shift it, which is easy to do now on the computer. It's nice and easy. Pitch shifted it so that I would, you know, what key's it in? Where's the closest on what box? Yeah. Okay, do that. For me to, it's like, I don't ever, I'm always, for me, very respectful that it's their thing. What do they want me to do? Working with Roger Daltrey, it's like, here's some Who songs. He doesn't tell us. There's a musical director, MD for that. When I first started doing stuff, I'd learn the songs and they just were like, there's not even an accordion part on bloody squeeze box, you know. So it's like, I just learned some chords, you know, went through. Fortunately, all the Who stuff's been charted, so that's quite easy to find online, so I didn't have to do that. And I turned up, and they, like, ran some songs I played along, absolutely delighted. And then, you know, other things, "Ah, can you do a bit like that?" Yeah, cool. It's their thing. what do they want?
But that's for when you're a session musician or you've been roped in to work with some, you know, interstellar musicians. Yeah. Like that. But when it's creations of your own bands and, you know, like the trios and the duos that you've worked with. So when it's literally brand new material, how does that work?
But
for you?
If you are, it's your thing, it's your band. So there are two things. It's either somebody's band or it's all your band. In my brain, you know, that's... So if it is... Trying to think of an example.
I mean, like Simpson Cutting Kerr, for instance, which
is... It's three people's band.
Mm.
It's our band. It's a trio. And nobody has a bigger voice than anyone else. Just because somebody might be bringing more material doesn't necessarily mean they have decided that's what they wanted to be. I suppose I'm very careful of working with people who are empathetic to other people's ways of working. You know, I've been in bands with whoever shouts the loudest is right, and it's not for me. It's like, it's fine. If it's your band, whatever you want to do, but if it's our band, you know, obviously if you have a 6-7 piece band, some voices get heard more than others, which is, in my school, in my head, that's fine. Then if somebody has a really terrible idea or an idea that one perceives as being terrible and they think it's the best idea in the world, for me, there's a little devilment in the, and this sounds really perverse, but in making that what I think is a pretty poor idea really good. What can I do to make that thing I don't like a thing that I like?
Yeah.
And I've got to do it because I don't like that. Whereas for lots of people, it's like, I don't want to do that. I think that's awful.
Yeah, and it could be a real kind of throw your toys at the pram moment, which would have happened, of course. Yeah. But it's more positive to sort of try and work with it.
You know, I also work very much on the principle of keeping my head down unless I feel strongly about something, because I find that I find it exhausting to fight people musically. It's just hard work and it's only music. It's like, it doesn't matter. You've got a brilliant idea that you think is the best thing since sliced bread. Fantastic, great. It's atrocious. But obviously I'm smiling again. Yeah, well, let's give it a go then. I'm going to try desperately hard to find a way to make it good. Then you'll be happy. Then the atmosphere will go, and we'll all chill out and have a nice time, and you'll be delighted.
Yeah.
And I'll be delighted because I've got a bit that I kind of like and I won.
You've proven to yourself that, I can take whatever rubbish.
It's easy. It's easy to, it can be easy. If you're in a group, duo, trio, quartet, whatever, and you work a lot, you play a lot together, it depends on what level and how intensely that is. It can be, especially if touring, it can be very easy to fall out.
Mm.
That's no fun for anyone
at
all. So it's like, try and find a way. You know, I think I'm probably still around because I tend to get on quite well with most people, you know.
But you've found a way to make that happen. You know, it's part of your nature, but it's also part of your nurture of yourself and learning how to do the job, really, isn't it? That's what it is.
Do your job as best you can. We're not all, you know, we don't all get it right all the time. I certainly don't get it. It's like, I get things, you know, sometimes monstrously wrong, you know, but it's like, it's all part of the life's rich tapestry.
It's how you then,
you know, it's
the recovery.
how you deal with it, you know.
Which is that's a lesson in life, isn't it? Okay.
Oh, totally.
I messed up there. How do I make this right?
Be honest. Yeah. Be totally honest. Yeah. Okay, look, I'm really sorry. I can't play this at the moment. You know, it's not happening for me at the moment. You know, I haven't had a chance to actually learn this particular thing. It's fine.
Yeah.
If somebody gives you a hard time about it, maybe they're not the right people to be working with, you know. It's like, there are always other people. Sometimes you might have to wait quite some time to meet those people or whatever. Or maybe you never will. But that's a far healthier situation to be in than in a situation of being with, you know, people who demonstratively don't like what you're doing or pick holes in whatever you're doing. It is only music. It doesn't matter. It matters greatly, of course, but it doesn't matter, you know.
That was the best bit of advice you ever gave me. Took me a while to... I said just off camera before we started this that it's only just gone in the last couple of weeks. It hasn't. I have revised it and gone back over it. But the turn your give a shitter down, or, you know, kind of care less about what you're doing. And like you just said, it matters greatly, but it doesn't matter to the be-all and end-all of everything else.
If it affects you, stops you having... It's like that great thing. It's not cool. I'm going to work music. I'm going to play music. Playing music. Yeah. It's playing. I think it's easy to lose the joy in it, you know.
100%. Wonderful. I've still got so many questions, but I think we've really kind of gone round so many beautiful houses in this conversation. I'm really, really so grateful that you offered.
You're very, very welcome.
You said yes to this. And that we've been able to do it in person. My first in-person podcast. So thank you so much for watching, everybody. Andy, have you got anything to plug? Like anything like up and coming over the next few months? Like, do you know where you're going to be?
No. Tomorrow? Leverett are going on tour in April. Is it end of April? Something like that. We're on to Leverett. Yeah, Leverett band. And it'll be nice to see people and watch me trying to remember...
Open up your Leverett filing 100 cabinet.
100 tunes, yeah. Dear me. The thought of a new record means that that'll be up to 120 or something.
Yeah. You can catch it with Andy online with andycutting.co.uk. Is that correct, your website?
You can, but I wouldn't look because I have no access. I've lost access to my website. I can't do anything. I can't change dates. I can't do anything. It's hopeless. So I need to rebuild a new... website.
Oh, well, maybe someone like Anne Leopold, who is building world websites
with her spare time. Yeah, I know, she's an amazing.
But
band.
Obviously, I'll put links to bands that we've mentioned downstairs in the description. Your Facebook page is updated more regularly, isn't it?
And yeah, like occasionally that, look at that.
Blows of Bella are going out as well. I know that, so I'll put.
Oh yeah, dates Blows of Bella in May. Yeah, we've got Blows of Bella things. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Wasn't that just something? I am so grateful to Andy for giving his time to me. Thank you so much, Andy. If you haven't done so already, I'd really appreciate a like and a share of this podcast. Give me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts if you listen there. Subscribe to my YouTube channel. Do all the good stuff to really help promote this podcast series. Subscribe to my Patreon if you're interested in getting the extended episodes. This month's is rather beefy because I left quite a lot in. You will also be able to get all of the previous episodes of the extended editions. I'm going to leave links to all of that in the description, so do go and have a look. And I'm also going to leave a link to Andy's guest tutor, Melinar, which he did for me in March. And you'll be able to go and learn what it is to play with other people and how you can get better at playing with groups. Really useful for him to have given all of his words of wisdom and advice. And you can get that via my Patreon. This month over on my Patreon, my guest tutor is the wonderful Pascal Rubens. She is one half of the Narragonia duo, and she's going to be doing a Melinar tutorial on the 25th of April. That's a Thursday night. It will be 7 p.m. UK time. You can join on Zoom live, or if you can't make the live, then you can catch up with the recording afterwards. Topic is right-hand rhythm and accompaniments. She is the queen of rhythm, in my opinion, and I absolutely love watching her control and mastery of accompanying tune and all of the other musicians that she plays with. So if you're interested in joining in with that and learning all of her pearls of wisdom, we're going to be leaving the link down in the description. That's it for this month. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you again next month. Bye.